Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello. From the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Byron Scott, your host for this week's discussion of world news events by professionals whose job it is to report the facts and analyze the consequences. Here's what one of our guests wrote recently about the topic of today's discussion, and I quote, "In those heady first days after the fall of the Taliban, anything seemed possible," unquote. Later in the same article, she added, "It is a different world now," unquote. Tomorrow is the 10th anniversary of America's longest war. On October 7, 2001, Operation Enduring Freedom was launched by the United States and its allies in Afghanistan. In June of this year, President Obama announced the beginning of a lengthy withdrawal of U.S. forces. What does a decade of war achieve for the Afghan public and for its journalists? Our guests share several things besides their beat. They all are familiar bylines whose stories often cover the human side of the Afghan conflict. And they've all been panelists on Global Journalist in this subject in the past decade. Let me introduce them. Gene McKenzie, who I just quoted, is a senior correspondent for Global Post based in Kabul. She first came to Afghanistan in 2004 and, in addition to reporting, has trained a network of Afghan journalists for the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. She's coming to us today from Rochester, New Hampshire, where she's home visiting. From Kabul, we have Anohita Mojindar, a widely published freelance journalist who came to Afghanistan's capital from India in 2003 and has been training journalists and is now settled in as a member of the press corps. And from Islamabad, we have Declan Walsh, Afghanistan and Pakistan foreign correspondent for The Guardian, who has been reporting in the region since 2004. Gene McKenzie, since I've quoted from one of your articles in my introduction, I'll ask you to start. Is there anything enduring about this war for Afghans, journalists, and the forces of democracy generally?
Well, there's a lot that's enduring about the war, I'm sure, about the freedom, after which the operation was named. 10 years after the invasion, it is arguable whether Afghanistan is much better off than where it started. If you're in Kabul and you see newly paved roads and buildings going up like mushrooms and people driving cars, it's easy to think that this past 10 years has achieved quite a bit. But when you talk to people and when you see what's happening out in the countryside, the picture becomes a lot darker. I think the major thing for me is the mood of the people. When I first arrived in 2004, people were very optimistic. They seemed very confident, very proud of their achievement, shaking off the Taliban and making the first steps on the road to a more stable and prosperous Afghanistan. But now, 10 years after the invasion, I think things are starting to fall apart, and Afghans are reflecting that, I think, in their outlook.
Let me move on now to Declan. Are things better or worse than they were earlier in the war?
Well, I largely agree with Gene. It's true that when you go to Afghanistan, on the surface and certainly in the urban areas, there are some visible signs of change and of progress. There's a lot more people living in the cities. There is a lot more wealth on display, particularly in Kabul. But it's easy to forget that there are now, at this point, large swathes of the country that are now at least under the sort of influence of the insurgents, these conflict-affected areas. And a lot of those very basic advances that have been made in areas like education and health simply don't apply to these people. So it's really a very unstable situation as far as they're concerned.
Anahid, with apologies for the mispronouncing your name. How would you answer that question? What is the enduring truth so far?
I couldn't really hear what Declan said, but I certainly agree with Jean that when I first came here, which was in 2003, there was a great deal of optimism, and that is almost nearly completely lost now. But I'll just illustrate with an example from today in Kabul. We had a political party which was demonstrating against what they termed was the American invasion of 2001. And yet in the morning, I attended a briefing by a large network of women's organizations, the Afghan Women's Network, which was absolutely critical of the way the security transition is taking place with the withdrawal of the international forces. So I think the last 10 years have been extremely mixed. And I think there have been a lot of progress in some areas. But the problem has been that the progress has been patchy, erratic, and most critically of all, it has been very reversible and fragile. And now I think, as Jean was saying, that we see those things falling apart.
Let me ask, since you and Jean have been involved with the training of Afghan journalists, essentially a whole new generation of journalists there. What is the situation now for the Afghan reporters? Anahita, Jean?
I think there have been very visible signs of progress in the media. If we go back to 2001, it would be difficult for there not to have been. There was very little media at all. We have some independent radio and television stations. We have some newspapers that are doing a very good job. But much as in the former Soviet Union, where I spent a lot of time, what we've seen in the past couple of years is the media becoming more and more politically engaged. We have what are loosely known as political figures, or otherwise known as warlords, buying up television stations and radio stations and using the media to get their message out. So I think we see a lot of young and enthusiastic reporters who are being taught by people like Anahita and myself the principles of journalism, that then when they are actually tasked by their editors or media outlets, find a very big disconnect between the things they've been taught and the things that they're asked to do.
Mm-hmm. Anahita, is that your observation as well, living in Kabul?
Yes, I actually wasn't a training journalist, but I did start up one of the media freedom newsletters, which is now brought out by Afghan colleagues. I think this aspect of the disconnect is extremely true. I think there's been a great deal of progress, and just in the time that I've been here, I've really seen a lot of especially young Afghan journalists mature, and they're out there at the scene asking really critical questions. But the operating environment for independent media, which seemed to be opening up, you know, in the initial years, that window has been shrinking rapidly.
Hmm. Let's ask Declan about operating as an international journalist in Afghanistan as well as Islamabad. How has that changed over the years?
Well, it's changed enormously on both sides of Durand Line, which is the border between the colonial border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Here in Pakistan, it, to some degree, I think the change has been more dramatic, because when I arrived here 7 years ago, it was largely a peaceful country. There weren't very many acts of terrorism or of militancy, particularly in areas like the capital of Islamabad or the other cities. That changed very dramatically from about 2007 on, after as President Pervez Musharraf started to lose his grip on power. We've seen an awful lot of violence here in the major cities. It's gone down to some degree this year, but journalists have very much been in the front line. As always, I have to stress, it's really local journalists, obviously, who are vastly more at risk than their international counterparts. We tend to be better resourced. We have more training. We have often very close networks of camaraderie between journalists who share information in difficult areas. And I'm sure my colleagues will agree that in Kabul, that's also the case. I think the international press tends to stay fairly close to itself, and people are very generous most of the time anyway in helping each other. But that doesn't mean that, of course, that there aren't risks. And we've seen some very close colleagues who've had near misses in Afghanistan, particularly on embeds with Western forces, or unfortunately some of them have been killed. I remember when I started in Afghanistan in 2004, when one went on an embed with US forces, you really had to try very hard to get sent to a place where there would be a chance of seeing some sort of conflict or some sort of fighting. Now it's almost, it seems to me that almost the opposite is the case.
The United Kingdom, politics in the United Kingdom currently is that Afghanistan is a very, very unpopular war. How has the Guardian's coverage changed over the years, Declan?
I suppose to some degree it reflected that. I think, you know, one of the more powerful, certainly symbolic things that has happened in the UK over the last certainly 2-3 years is that the funeral processions for soldiers who have died, mostly in the southern province of Helmand, those funeral processions have been going through a town called Wooden Basset when they come off the plane and they're brought for burial. And that's had a very powerful galvanizing impact on public opinion in Britain, where people on their television sets every evening or every evening that it happens, have had this kind of demonstration, this very graphic representation of the fact that their soldiers are dying in this war. And I suppose the real problem is that the politicians have had great difficulty in explaining to the public why exactly those soldiers have been dying, because it seems, certainly from an outside perspective, to be a war, an open-ended war, that for most of the time didn't seem to have a very solid goal. The goal was to, or has been, or is, to bolster the Afghan government, to create the conditions in which the Afghan government can thrive. But there's so much cynicism, so much fighting about the ability of President Karzai and of his provincial officials to deliver on that. There's been so much coverage in the press, including in our paper, about very costly battles that Western soldiers have fought in places like Kandahar and Helmand, capture ground battles that have been expensive in terms of munition and money, but more importantly in terms of young people's lives, and that so many times after those battles have been fought, the Afghan government has failed to hold that ground, and then it has seemed to have been in vain.
Let me hold you at that point for a minute, and before we continue this discussion, I want to remind our audience that you can view or listen to this program at any time by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You'll also be interested in the articles, interviews, and other features that are part of this website. You also can send us questions or comments, care of Global Journalist Program at gmail.com, or simply look us up on Facebook. Back to you, Declan, quickly. The Taliban are still there, and President Karzai has announced that he's beginning to talk directly with them.
Well, his most recent pronouncement, actually, oddly enough, is that, I mean, that's broadly true, but most recently he said, rather wryly, that he's not going to talk to the Taliban now, he's going to talk to Pakistan, because, of course, this has turned into a very bitter regional row, with accusations, not just from Afghan officials, but also from the most senior American ones, saying that the Taliban leadership have been sheltering here in Pakistan, in the tribal areas, and in the province of Balochistan over the last decade, basically. And most recently, we've seen accusations from the U.S. that Pakistan's military intelligence service, the ISI, has been directly aiding some of these groups, and there's even been a very incendiary suggestion that they may have helped to direct an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Kabul on September 13th. So it's not just about the fighting, it's also very much at the moment about the geopolitics, particularly as we face into the drawdown of American troops, which is now starting, and the sort of complete withdrawal of the bulk of the Western forces, certainly by 2014, the end of 2014.
Mm-hmm. Gene McKenzie, you have spent a lot of time out in the country as well, including a significant amount of time in Helmand province, I believe. Why are the Taliban seemingly on resurgence?
I think that there's something that we haven't completely understood about the Taliban. I mean, from the American military perspective, we look at them as some sort of an invading force, something from outside, where actually the Taliban are Afghan people. They spring from the Afghan people. In places like Helmand, where I did spend quite a bit of time, they are your neighbors, your uncles, your friends, your classmates. The Taliban cannot be divorced from the people in many parts of Afghanistan. And as we continue to try to demonize them and try to separate them from the Afghan people, it makes our efforts that much more hopeless. I think until we understand the extent to which the Taliban do represent a certain facet of Afghan society and a certain facet of the Afghan people's visions of themselves, we cannot begin to try to combat what we see as an insurgency.
Anahita, would you agree with Jean in that observation?
Yeah, I certainly think at its heart there is an insurgency within Afghanistan with probably varying degrees of support from outside. I think the problem has been that the Taliban functions like a very elastic and flexible web through the country. But the military strategy that has been used against them is one like the battering ram. So if you go and push a web with a battering ram, it seems as if that web is disappearing and going away. But the minute you remove that force, the web comes right back. And if you look at the conditions on the ground, which actually led to the Taliban first emerging as a force in the 1990s, which was not just based on their ideology, but on issues like injustice, corruption, brutality, and violence, which was there in Afghan society during the Civil War, a lot of those conditions are being recreated throughout Afghanistan today, even if not at the same level. So the same warlords who were predatory and preyed on the people and therefore made the Taliban welcome are back in power. So the Taliban to some people seem like a welcome return.
Would you say that life is any better or worse for the typical Afghan, Anahita?
Well, I think there is nothing like a typical Afghan. Of course, in the urban centers, I mean, I live in Kabul, but cities like Mazar-e-Sharif, Herat, there's been a great deal of progress, especially for women who absolutely had no participation in public life. But if you go into areas where the military conflict is intense, I'm sure a lot of people would say the situation is much worse, because during the Taliban times, there was law and order as well as a certain peace. Extremely oppressive and perhaps extremely brutal, but there was a system and there was a functioning of some kind which seems to be absent right now.
Declan Walsh, how would you answer that question? Is life any better or worse for the typical Afghanistan resident?
I think It really, as Anahita said, it depends on where you live in Afghanistan. There certainly are people who've benefited, but unfortunately, I'd say they're in the minority. And I think for people who do live outside, who live in the southern part of the country and increasingly in other parts of the country, not only are they not benefiting from the fruits of Western aid or whatever good the Western intervention has brought, but they are becoming directly caught up in the conflict. So, you know, clearly things weren't great under the Taliban to start with. There was, of course, a civil conflict that had been going on in various forms for several decades, and the Taliban era was no exception to that. The American invasion, or the American-assisted invasion 10 years ago, interrupted a Taliban campaign against Shah Massoud's people in northern Afghanistan. So certainly, you know, locally, I'm sure there are people who've benefited, but I think overall, if we look at the goals that the international community set itself, taking over Afghanistan 10 years ago, and it's the record, unfortunately, or the products, rather, is very dismal.
Gene, you've seen this in other countries of the particularly of the former Soviet bloc. Is this a pattern to be expected as the NGOs and other infrastructure groups and forces of reform begin to withdraw?
Well, I think that Afghanistan is quite different from the Soviet bloc in that the Soviet Union, whatever its faults, certainly did have infrastructure, and that is missing in Afghanistan. I think as the NGOs begin to shut down, as they will do because funding is decreasing, we are going to see a collapse of many of the things that have been put in place over the past 10 years in terms of civil society. And as Anahit pointed out, we have an increasing rise of some very negative aspects of society, what we used to call the warlords, who are being armed, trained, and funded increasingly by the foreign forces, who are hoping that they will help them combat the Taliban. I think as the foreign forces withdraw, and the foreign presence in terms of NGOs and other types of organizations begin to leave, we're going to see an increasing level of internal conflict and violence in Afghanistan itself.
Anahita, is your observation pretty much, and your prediction pretty much as Jean's?
Yes, I completely agree with the fact that as the funding is going to withdraw, a lot of the developments are going to collapse because they've been based on quick impact, pleasing the donor, pleasing the domestic audiences of the international community. So it's been more about setting up school buildings and counting how many buildings there are rather than seeing whether actual education is being delivered in those buildings, for example. And I think it isn't so difficult for the international community to have got their act together. I mean, there are two basic principles. One is whether the development is sustainable, and the second, which goes to what Jean was saying about corrupt people being armed and empowered, the second principle is of doing no harm. It is a very well-established principle of disbursing aid, that you make sure that the aid you're going is not going to do harm to the population where it's going. And that principle was completely abandoned by the major players of the international donors when they came in 2001, thereby empowering, arming, financing a lot of the negative elements of society.
Declan, I'm going to give you the final word here. Can you give us a prediction for the region as the drawdown continues?
It's probably too much in flux at the moment to give any hard prediction. There is a strategic partnership, basically a withdrawal agreement that's currently being negotiated between the U.S. and the Afghan government. And that's going to determine what the level of American engagement in Afghanistan is after 2014. Most specifically, it's going to determine how many U.S. troops will remain behind, because there will apparently be some American military presence. Most of the speculation at the moment seems to think there'll be somewhere between 10 and 20,000 U.S. troops in a supporting role for the Afghan government. So, you know, in that scenario, there is a possibility that even if civil conflict or internal conflict increases, that, you know, the central government will be propped up. I think Afghanistan's biggest problem, and it's a problem that affects the entire region, is that the internal politics are very fragile. The government is extremely weak. And if that were to collapse in any form, or if ethnic conflicts were to, you know, dramatically increase, that could place the Western forces in a very difficult position.
I'm afraid I have to
extend far outside Afghanistan's borders.
Okay, I'm afraid I have to cut off this discussion, which has gone far quicker than the war seems to have, and far more successfully. I want to thank our guests for their insights, Anahita Mojumdar, Gene McKenzie, and Declan Walsh. Our director is Joe Deutschman, audio by Pat Akers. Our executive producer is Raymond Tungekar. The lead producer for this show was David Cawthon, assisted by Ryan Kress and Jessica Popovec. This is Byron Scott for Global Journalist, reminding you that you can download, view, or listen to this show, plus additional features, by going to globaljournalist.org. Join us next week as journalists open their journals to take us inside their stories. And now, stay tuned. Free Press Watch comes along next.
And now, Global Journalist Free Press Watch, where each week we bring you a roundup of major events in press freedom around the world. I'm Jessica Popovac. A cameraman in Yemen has become the second journalist to lose his life since massive anti-government demonstrations began in that country in February. Hassan al-Wadaf died on Saturday, 5 days after he was struck by sniper fire while covering a protest. Several demonstrators were also killed that day. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that several reporters in Yemen have been threatened, arrested, or have had their equipment confiscated in recent months. And in Britain, a movement to create tighter restrictions on the press is gaining momentum. Actor Hugh Grant, whose 1995 arrest in L.A. made international headlines, has been at the helm of the movement, which includes several other celebrities and crime victims. They are calling for an end to what they say is an intrusion into their private lives. Several media professionals have expressed concerns that the regulations could go too far and jeopardize freedom of the press in the UK. And the Jordanian parliament has indefinitely postponed a debate on a proposed anti-corruption bill. The bill would have levied massive fines against anyone publicly accusing officials of corruption without sufficient proof. It was vehemently opposed by the Jordan Press Association and other free press advocates. As always, you can find links to these and other stories on our website at www.globaljournalist.org. On behalf of everyone here at Global Journalist Radio, thank you for joining us.
Hello, and welcome back, Global Journalist. Welcome to this sidebar of our discussion of the results of the Afghan War 10 years on. I'm talking with Akbar Ayazi from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Prague. And it would take all of our time available to introduce him properly, but suffice it to say that he is a distinguished journalist whose commentaries you've seen on CNN, Al Jazeera, and any other number of shows. He is the regional director for RFE for Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and Iraq. And so respected is he that he moderated the first ever Afghan presidential debates to feature a sitting president, Hamid Karzai. Welcome to the sidebar, and we're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be on this show.
10 years on, what can we point to in the Afghanistan war of a positive nature?
Well, when is the war and when is the positive? You know, when it's war is always negative. But
yes. If
we look at the positive things that have happened in Afghanistan, many things have happened. Millions of students and children are going to schools. Over 5,000 kilometers of road has been built. Economy has improved. People's livelihood has gotten better. But it would have been much better if there was no war and there was no insurgency and there was security and peace. And that's where the problem is, where the people are not happy because things did not happen the way they expected initially.
You said that journalism is one of the better things that's happened, a rise of a new generation of journalists. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, one of the good things that has happened in Afghanistan, probably Afghanistan has the most free media now in the region, excluding India, Pakistan, Iran, and northern neighbors of all the Central Asian countries. Journalism has flourished. The country has more than 23 private television channels, hundreds of FMs, and tens of printed media publications. So this is a very positive thing. The country didn't have a media law, and now it has a media law. Yes, it has been put in the list of not free media countries by the Freedom House. But relatively, the media is quite free, but of course it has challenges. There are hundreds of young men and women who are active in the field of journalism. A good competition is taking place in recruiting good journalists. Radio Free Europe for Afghanistan has probably the largest network of reporters in every province of the country, a large bureau in Kabul, 35, 36 journalists, and we're doing live broadcasts from Kabul simultaneously while we do this from Prague.
Let me ask about the pressures on independent journalists at the local level.
Yes, definitely. It's not only the local level. It's always in the national level. There are, of course, a challenges of all the journalists in media has. They get intimidation. They're intimidated. They get threatening calls, SMSs, or text messages from Taliban, from extremists, from warlords, from drug lords. They're always in conflict with these poor journalists. But at the same time, you know, we have had cases where our journalists were kidnapped by Taliban of Radio Free Europe or Radio Azadi, as known in Afghanistan. So this challenge is always there. They can get intimidated by the local authorities. But I'm speaking all relatively when you consider every development that has taken place in the country. Media is doing pretty good. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we do have a media outlets that are owned by private individuals with private and their interest, and also with financial support from outside neighboring countries. In particular, I could say in Iran and Pakistan, where they promote the agenda of the foreign financiers or their personal interest.
Let me ask you one final question here. What do you see as the future of Afghan media now that international forces are withdrawing?
Well, if the international forces withdraw the way we see it, or it's been told, it's not going to be only the media that's going to be affected. It's going to be every aspect of the life of the Afghan population is going to be affected. Insurgency is going to grow. The government will not be able to withstand the insurgency. And if the whole international community and all the forces leave, I'm afraid we're going to be back to square one. And when you go back to square one, every aspect of life of the Afghans is going to be affected.
Thank you, Mr. Ayazi, and we appreciate you spending a little time with Global Journalist.
My pleasure.